Yeah! Kick it!
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and I'm in London with my colleagues Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Murison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us from New York City to discuss all that's new in the world's largest archive of music journalism is Mr. Alan Light. Welcome, Alan.
Hello, Barney. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Our guest has quite a CV to boast of. He started at Rolling Stone in 1989. He became the editor-in-chief of Vibe magazine in 1994. And he then assumed the same role at Spin in 1999. And he's also written books about Tupac Shakur, the Beastie Boys, and Prince. And he worked with the late Greg Allman on 2012's autobiography, My Cross to Bear. First off, Alan, how did you persuade the American Studies Department at Yale University to let you write your senior thesis on the Beastie Boys' Licensed to Ill?
I am fated forever to start with this, aren't I?
Sorry,
it's all right. I'm proud of it. I'm delighted to still talk about it. Listen, I was at Yale in whatever it is, the mid '80s. I was class of 1988, and right in the middle of that time, I guess, in late '86 was when the Licensed to Ill album came out. And, you know, growing up at that moment where hip hop was exploding and sort of beginning to take over the world, I was, you know, like so many, fascinated by them because I looked at the Beastie Boys and thought, that could be me and two of my idiot friends so easily. If we just, it's all, we listen to the same records, we're, you know, it's all, if we were just sort of shameless and, you know, dopey enough, like that's the path we could have gone. And, but watching that phenomenon unfold and watching Licensed to Ill become the biggest selling debut album in Columbia Records history to that point and become hip hop's first number one album and all those things, clearly all the issues that it raised about, you know, about race and about crossover and about audience and also about the production techniques that Rick Rubin was using, which were technically not even sampling yet. It wasn't even samplers. They were tape loops.
Yes.
And it was the 80s and we were talking about postmodernism a lot. And I just thought, you know, a lot of the stuff that I was talking about in the American studies world, in this sort of cultural studies, you know, territory that I was working in, this was a really rich thing to look at, you know, with that framework around it. And I have to say, the American Studies Department was fantastic, and I owe them, you know, tremendous gratitude because they let me. This was within you choose a concentration within the major. Most of them are American history or American literature, but I did an American pop music concentration. So I had to work pretty closely with them just to figure out, are there enough classes and which courses would count and how can we sort of put this thing together? And when I came to them with the idea of, here's this group, the Beastie Boys, and here's what's going on, you know, nobody fought me on that. They just spent the time to figure out, okay, what will it take to make this feel legit? What, you know, does it feel like there's enough here to pursue? And they weren't going to give me the American Studies prize, but I was a finalist for the prize for that thesis. So I take that as a win.
Nice. Very nice.
Wonderful. Wonderful. You didn't have any problems with the Marxist feminist.
I actually had a Marxist feminist advisor on the, now that you, say that, that's actually quite literally true. Somebody who was sort of a media studies person was the advisor that we worked with, which did keep a pretty, you know, tight clamp on some of the obvious problematic things going on around that album. But I'm, you know, in the end, I'm grateful for sort of getting out ahead of confronting a lot of that stuff and wrestling with it at that point rather than sort of, sure, the world catching up to that later on down the line. So it was the easiest relationship with my advisor on some of that, but she pushed me, you know, to actually do some work.
Was she aware of the women in cages on the stage?
Well, I wrote about them, so I guess she was aware.
All right. Of course, the irony is the Beasties became deeply right on in their old age, didn't
absolutely
they?
Absolutely.
No, listen, it's a you know, of course, the Beastie story, which I eventually did I think it's on the site, a massive, I think we were looking at it, a 12,000 word oral history of the Beastie Boys. That's a spin cover when Hello Nasty came out, which I ended up expanding into a book called The Skills to Pay the Bills that came out subsequently. You know, tracking the Beastie Boys story turned out to be far more interesting than any of us would have anticipated.
Sure.
You know, what felt like maybe kind of a one joke thing
yeah.
early on
yeah, yeah.
turned out to have a lot more longevity and a lot more layers to it than we expected.
Mm. Absolutely.
It really did. Given like the success of that first Beasties album, when you joined Rolling Stone, having interned there,
yeah.
what was the coverage of hip hop like at the magazine?
It was insufficient and it was kind of scattershot. It wasn't invisible, but it, you know, was very arbitrary is not the right word, but it felt very sort of catch can what got in the magazine. There wasn't necessarily a lot of sort of logic to it, which things got covered and at what size they got covered. And, you know, it was on the one hand, you know, when I joined and initially, you know, in the fact-checking department and trying to start to write and trying to find stuff to do, being an advocate for hip-hop, it's not that I met resistance from the editors there. It really was a sense of like, we haven't sort of had anybody who's an advocate for this stuff before. Mm-hmm. And once I made, you know, one or two things that were sort of, you know, felt like good calls, you know, getting stuff in that then turned out to be big records or, you know, okay, yes, it's good that we covered that. I was given a relatively free hand to sort of direct what the, you know, what the coverage was going to be, what was going to get into the book. Now, it wasn't always, everything always was sort of one step smaller than what I would have liked, mm-hmm. right? Things that I thought should have been features that ended up being sort of front of book pieces, things that were big features that should have gone on the cover of the magazine. You know, everything was sort of one, pushing one fight, you know, one level up. But I think that in, you know, overall, it felt like there was sort of some relief among the staff, you know, among the editors saying, okay, here's somebody who is paying attention to this stuff and can sort of tell us a little bit more what needs to be in here. And I got to write, you know, I said writing about hip hop, you know, in the late 80s into the early 90s is like writing about, you know, jazz in the 40s or writing about rock yes. and roll in the 60s. It's like the greatest golden era, you know, most explosive moment of creativity. And so I got to write about, you know, Public Enemy and Beastie Boys and De La Soul and NWA and Ice-T and, you know, sort of the, you know, the most amazing list of Hall of Fame, you know, transformative artists at a time where there weren't 75 people lining up outside a conference room to talk to these people. I mean, sure. I got to spend, you know, real time and real days and have real access to these guys because they just weren't being recognized in the media the way that they would be a couple of years later.
I mean, interestingly, I've been writing for NME for probably about 5-6 years when the NME really did start paying attention to rap and hip hop. I mean, we had Richard Grable on the podcast last year, and he was obviously writing about what was happening in the South Bronx and elsewhere as early as, you know, 80-81. So I think, you know, NME was quite fast off the case. And then when the Beasties happened and Def Jam artists started to attract a lot of attention, there was really quite a lot of coverage in NME at that time.
The one recurring thing that we hear from the writers is that getting black faces on the cover of the magazine is something which harms sales. There was a lot of resistance to having a black face on the cover of the magazines.
Yeah, particularly when it wasn't with the sense of that these were, and this was obviously being discounted at the time, but that mm-hmm. these were seen as crossover acts with a pop following. I mean, it wasn't Michael Jackson. It wasn't, you know,
absolutely
sort of acts that were so inescapably, you know, multiracial audience that they're, you know, didn't have the same sort of a fight. So sure. It wasn't two things. One was, you know, getting hip hop into Rolling Stone was, you know, it wasn't a, where everybody's priority was, but it wasn't a massive struggle. Also, there was a recognition that like, okay, skate kids are listening to this stuff, and like Axl's wearing an NWA hat, you know, that within the sort of rock and roll world, there was a presence for this stuff. What was really difficult for me to get in was anything sort of on the more, you know, contemporary R&B side.
Right, to get
TLC in, to get Mary J. Blige in, those were seen as, you know, not only too black, but too female in their audience. And I know we'll transition into talking about launching Vibe, but when we launched Vibe, over and over again, my argument was, look, of course, the hip hop stuff is sort of the cultural foundation for the sensibility of what this magazine is. But if we can get the R&B stuff right and really recognize the kind of stars that those artists are and, you know, how massive they are, that's where there's a wide open lane for us to really grow something that nobody else is addressing. You know, yeah, I can get, you know, LL Cool J into Rolling Stone and something like The Source exists as a pure hip hop outlet. But if we can get that sort of, you know, what became urban music sort of black pop space, right, then we're really looking at something that can, you know, grow very quickly.
Right.
One of the things that's interesting to me when you read particularly white coverage of hip hop from the early days is that it's sort of sometimes, not always, but sometimes seen as a sort of passing fad, as a sort of trend, as something that will blow over and that will be sort of done within a few years' time. And I was just wondering whether that was something that you felt at that time, or what was your sort of lookout on the genre when you were writing about it initially?
Well, I think you are hyper aware of that a lot of people were saying that a lot of the industry was saying that a lot of people were wishing that. And that a lot of the, you know, bigger media coverage was really, you know, controversy out. You know, that there would be a, you know, a rap cover of Newsweek was Tone Loke because of the, you know, wilding in Central Park. Like that was where you would see this being covered. It was as like a news piece, not as a music piece.
On criminality, and, on essentially on criminality.
On criminality, on, you know, on urban violence, on you know, even when it was given sort of some respect, it was as this, you know, dispatch from the urban jungle sort of a thing. Yeah. And so, you know, look, I think the reality was being a white guy covering hip hop in the early days, you know, of course you kept, it was only appropriate to sort of keep race first in your brain and remember what it was that you were doing. But I also didn't feel like I met a lot of, you know, challenge or resistance from the artists because they were just welcoming anybody who was writing about this as music and as an art form and as a culture.
Yeah.
That they were used to talking to sort of, you know, the hip hop zine press. And if there was any mainstream attention, again, it was through this lens of you guys are thugs.
Yeah.
And so just the ability to walk in a room and like actually know something about the music and be able to talk about the records was, I think, you know, regardless of the, you know, of, again, being a white guy coming into the room, that was a rare enough experience that sort of felt like what was most important that was going on.
Yeah. So we've made Vibe the subject of the week's free feature on the homepage, and have three pieces about Vibe, including Angus Beatty's 2003 celebration of the first decade of the magazine. When, Alan, did you first hear sort of rumblings of the fact that Quincy Jones was planning a hip hop magazine with Time Inc. or Time Warner?
So I was at, you know, I was at Rolling Stone, and look, the it was very much the other thing about particularly the sort of hip hop media at that time was it was such a sort of cottage industry. There were a handful of writers at that, you know, there were really a handful of labels. And you would go out and you would see the same people, you know, every night at wherever the party was. On Mondays, it was at Fez. On Tuesdays, it was Negril. And you would sort of all do the circuit of where the, you know, the, which club was, you know, the right place to be on that night. So when conversation started about this magazine, you know, they approached some folks who were friends of mine working at other magazines. Jonathan Van Meter, who was at Vogue at the time, you know, was approached initially to come and edit Vibe. A dear friend of mine, Diane Cardwell, you know, we had all worked together at a magazine called 7 Days that the Village Voice was publishing for a brief period of time. That was my first sort of actual job in between interning at Rolling Stone and going back. And so, we were all very close, and they got approached to work on, well, I guess Jonathan got approached and then brought in Diane to work on this project. And then they came to me saying, if we want to do this sort of Rolling Stone of hip hop, you know, do you want to come and join us? And initially they worked on the way that a lot of magazine launches worked then, especially from a place like Time Inc. that had the money. They would do a test issue, complete one full issue, and put that to newsstands and then see how that performed and then sort of decide if they were going to go forward. So they assembled kind of a full staff and a full thing to do one issue. Yeah. And I said, well, I'm not going to leave Rolling Stone to go work on one issue and not know if that's going to move forward or not. So I sort of under the table helped introduce them to writers and bring people in and sort of help put pieces together for that. That test issue came out. It performed well enough that then they got the green light to go forward. And when they got approved to actually launch as a magazine, then I left Rolling Stone to go be initially the music editor at Vibe when we launched in 1993.
In retrospect, very significant that Van Meter, who was the first, you know, editor in chief, had come from Vogue. For me, I mean, because obviously the magazine, you know, when we first saw it, it had these incredible kind of design values and photographic values. It was almost like it was as influenced by sort of Vogue and Vanity Fair as it was by Rolling Stone, and that was a real statement, wasn't it, in terms of. We're taking this art form very seriously.
I think very, very intentionally the visual element and the presentation of these artists as these are superstars.
Yeah.
You know, this is not about we're going to put them up against a brick wall with graffiti on it and sort of shoot a snapshot and like that's going to be it. But we're going to shoot them the way that, you know, that Vanity Fair would shoot them, the way that, you know, Richard Avedon would shoot them and present them as those kinds of icons was really, you know, central, I think, to the idea of the magazine from the beginning. And I think really important to Quincy, you know, there developed tension between Quincy and Jonathan about direction of the magazine that results in Jonathan leaving and me taking over in the editor-in-chief position. But I do think that that sense of this needs to have that feeling of, you know, star power and sophistication was a big piece from the beginning.
Did you have significant interactions with Quincy in those early days?
Yeah, a bit. I mean, he would sort of, you know, particularly around launch, there was all the event stuff and all the presenting it and taking out to the world. And, you know, that was sort of the most time spent with him. And we would, you know, he would check in and weigh in, you know, various moments about this or that. The moment I'll never forget, just because it's like, you know, we were at the launch party in LA, the magazine was about to come out and we're sitting at a table and Quincy said, I remember this is what I said to Michael right before Thriller came out. And I was like, dude, stop. Like, I understand, like I'll finish the thought, but don't tell me that launching this magazine is like right before Thriller came out. Like, don't put that on me right now. So, it was always that. I mean, it was always this sort of, you know, being in the presence of Quincy was, you know, this wild thing. But look, it opened a lot of doors. It obviously helped. Like that was when you could walk in the door saying, this is Quincy's magazine. Like you'd get the meeting.
Yeah.
You know, everybody sort of understood what that meant and what that endorsement meant. I wasn't there. I think there was much more hands-on involvement, especially during that sort of test phase, you know, sort of really leading up to what is this magazine going to be?
Sure.
And I wasn't, you know, in the mix so much then, we were kind of off and running by the time I joined. So it was, it was more the pleasure of, hey, that's Quincy Jones.
Was there ever for you a sense of awkwardness of being a white journalist running a magazine about and for the black community?
Sure. I mean, I had awkwardness, I guess. But I mean, the only responsible thing was to keep that front and center.
Yes.
You know, at all times. And you make decisions. Look, so we launched the magazine. The first year is kind of a bit of a bumpy ride. There's things that do really well. There's things that don't do as well. Mm-hmm. There's trying to figure out the direction and the emphasis. And, you know, again, eventually Jonathan and Quincy sort of split in that, you know, in the vision of that. And Jonathan leaves and the ownership of the magazine comes to me and asks me to take over as the editor-in-chief. Mm-hmm. I was 27 years old.
Right.
I had never managed anything. I had never seen a budget. I had never done any of this sort of administrative stuff. But it really was like, look, we've got – and this is this sounds overdramatic, but this is true. I was – they asked me to take over the magazine, and they said, you have 3 months to – significantly cut the budget, significantly show newsstand growth, and kind of, steer, wow. Right the ship. You have 3 issues to do. I'm like, that's so crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was also like, well, we can't have somebody come in from outside at that point with that kind of timetable. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, at least I can sort of try to grab the wheel and hang on. Mm-hmm. And that was very much, what that felt like. And all the sort of business side were super supportive and helpful and great. And we got through it. And I brought my dear friend Danielle Smith in to be the music editor.
Right.
And sort of really work very close with me to kind of try to get it all together. And she's so fantastic. And we became, super close and remain, and we figured it out. Those 3 issues, the next 3 issues, as it happened, the Prince cover that we're going to talk about was coming up. That was one of them. She did a Janet Jackson cover that right. then followed that. And the third was getting TLC to pose in firemen's outfits right after the Lisa burning down her boyfriend's house in Atlanta.
That's right. And of course. Yes.
Those 3 issues all sort of, got all this attention and coverage and exploded and sort of got everything stabilized yeah. for the magazine. I'm not just another fan, I am the man, and I don't give a damn about who you know. I got a 48-track studio back at the crib, so drop by, you know where I live. I see you all the time, but on another note, would you like to dance? No, I'm about to go and hang my coat. So there's all of that going on. And then on top of that, this was one white guy replacing another white guy at the top mm-hmm. of yep. this magazine. And so what was especially important to me was – again, there weren't a lot of people out there writing about this stuff. So there wasn't a lot of sort of established senior level, writers of color, editors of color who had sure. been given that experience out there. And so, I really tried to focus on growing from the sort of assistants and younger editors right. and really developing what is the next, not the next generation, but 2 years from now, what yes, does this sure. look like? Mm. And there were things I did that were right and things I did that I wasn't as aware of or wasn't thinking as much about mm-hmm. the sensitivity of the moment. And we were kids and we were making it up. So you do your best. And, I think that what we accomplished with the magazine. And again, when I look around and see what all of those members of the team went on to do and accomplish at Vibe yes. and elsewhere,
yeah.
that's the thing that I'm very proud of.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, rightly so. It's a fabulous magazine.
Yeah. Shall we talk about that Prince piece?
And do it all day.
Prince breaks the silence. I mean, he literally had not given an interview for the best part of 4 years, had he?
And
Maybe 5. You've talked in another interview that I read about kind of flirting with Prince for about 18 months, just trying to kind of bring him to the table. And it's obviously an incredibly interesting moment because, he's beginning his feud with Warners and he's dropping his name and becoming this unpronounceable squiggle. So take us back to, I guess 1993, the piece comes out in 94, but your first yeah. kind of flirtations were 93. Take us back to that.
So it starts when I'm still at Rolling Stone and I was a massive Prince fan and looking for excuses and reviewed some of the albums, and I went to cover the opening of the Love Symbol album tour, which was opened in Florida, and I went down and covered the opening 2 or 3 nights of that and was around, not around him, but sort of around the team a little bit and around some of the band a little bit, doing all that stuff. And that review came out and I got a call from his publicist who I've been working with saying, look, he's thinking about doing an interview. It's been a long time and, maybe you're the right, maybe you're the right person. You've sort of been circling this. Like, okay, fantastic, but you should know I'm actually about to leave Rolling Stone and go launch this magazine, go work on launching this magazine called Vibe. That's Quincy's magazine. And they were sort of like, well, that could even be better. Like he could be more excited about that. And the Quincy thing and the, you know, all of that could be great. So, you know, let's see. And at the, you know, sort of the conclusion or the follow-up to that call was, okay, you know, he wants to see you in San Francisco tomorrow. Show up at the airport. This was, you know, 1993. Show up at the airport tomorrow. The ticket will be waiting. Someone will pick you up at the airport. So I leave my desk in New York and I go to the airport and show up in San Francisco. And, you know, yes, somebody picks me up at the airport, takes me to, I go meet him at soundcheck for that show and hang out with him through soundcheck, on stage, off stage, whatever, backstage, go to the show. We go out after the show. And all of this is like, this isn't, we're just talking. Like, this is not, we're not doing anything here. We're just hanging out. And I go back to New York, you know, after sitting on the piano bench with Prince and, you know, doing all this stuff. And of course, I can't record. I can't take notes.
Yeah.
First of all, because it's not yet an interview. And second of all, because even if it was, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And then over the course of the next year, year and a half, every few months, I'd get a call. He wants to see you at Paisley tomorrow. You know, and so I'd fly out to Paisley.
Was it always tomorrow?
It was usually tomorrow.
In fact, this afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'd fly to Minneapolis and we'd go watch him rehearse. And okay, great. Say hello, talk for a minute, go back and fly back. Okay, he's going to be in New York next week. You know, let's meet him then. And this every few months for, you know, the better part of a year, these calls come. And then finally, and it is as the sort of struggle with Warner's continues and he puts out the Most Beautiful Girl in the World single through Bellmark Records. And that becomes sort of the biggest hit in a long time. And they call and they're like, okay, now's the time. Like he's got something, you know, he's got something on his mind because of all the business stuff and he's got a hit and we're setting up the thing. And what, you know, the conclusion being he has to go to Monte Carlo to do the World Music Awards. And he's kind of parked there for like 3 or 4 days.
So can you be in Monte Carlo tomorrow?
Can you come to Monte Carlo? I don't think that was tomorrow, okay. But I think it was maybe next week.
If you insist, fine.
So off I go to Monte Carlo and spend several days with him in the hotel at rehearsal. He does after shows, you know, both nights at those. And though this is now, okay, we're now doing this for a story, I still can't take notes or record with him. So it's still the same crazy process of like scribbling notes when you can and reconstructing conversations and like all of that stuff. But then when I come back from that, it's like, okay, now, you know, we have a story that then becomes this Vibe cover story in summer of 94. So it was a saga. It was incredible. It was, you know, unbelievable to be within that orbit and, you know, and not just to be within that orbit sort of for a day, but over this extended period of time, then was trying to figure out how do I write a story out of this? But, you know, it was like, I'll never, obviously never have anything like that again in my life.
Did you like Prince as a guy?
I did very much. And I think that when people ask, you know, the biggest surprise is like how sort of regular a guy he was. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but that it wasn't like sitting with a space alien when you would sit in a hotel room with him, you know. Yes, he would do 3 costume changes on days when he didn't have a show. Yes. But, you know, that we would talk about basketball or we would talk about, you know, movies that were out or sort of talk about things that placed him in the world in a way that, you know, you just don't think of or see, you know, while at the same time being so hyper aware that he had created this universe that nothing touched him unless he brought it inside and that everything was set up so that he could create at moment's notice anywhere in the world. And this is a pre-home studio world. That meant if he was on tour and he was in Dayton and it was 3 o'clock in the morning and he had an idea, you know, the band knew they could get a call saying, you know, report for duty now. There was an engineer on standby. There was a studio on hold. That was true 365 days a year, no matter where he was. So just being around that sort of, you know, output and these days of, you know, 2 hours of sound check, 2.5 hours of a show, and then a 3 hour after show, like making that band play for 6-7 hours a day, was just, you know, a discipline unlike anything that, you know, I'd ever witnessed.
Extraordinary.
I was lucky enough to work with Susan Rogers back in the late ages. And she talked to me about, she'd go on the road, she'd be his live sound engineer, go to the after party, the jam after party, be the live sound engineer for that. Go to the nearest 24-track recording studio. Go in there. She said she did this for months on end. This is basically with the Revolution, with Wendy and Lisa and those guys. And she said eventually she got back to her home to Los Angeles, had finally gotten to sleep at the end of this tour. The phone rings and it's Prince saying, I want you to come to the studio. And she said, no. And that was the last time he spoke to her. That was the end of that.
Yeah. I love this exchange. When I wrote my book about the making of Purple Rain, my book Let's Go Crazy, I talked to everybody involved, but to Susanna Melvoin,
right,
who was, you know, he was the singer in the family. She's Wendy's twin sister. And she would say, you know, when they were living together, it'd be 4 o'clock in the morning, the phone would ring. She'd answer. He'd say, what are you doing? She'd say, I'm sleeping. And he would say,
He would say,
wrong answer. I'm cutting hits. Click.
Wrong answer. Oh,
I'm cutting hits. That was the thing. Man. But anyway, to the question, he was funny and he was engaging and curious.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, not like you were, I mean, in some ways you were going to another planet when you were around him, but on the other hand, it didn't feel, once you sort of swallowed hard and got over the intimidation of it, wasn't that.
Yeah.
He didn't wake you at 2:30 in the morning after you'd had an hour's sleep and say, I'm ready to answer questions.
He didn't do, though, you know, though you're also aware that could happen.
I love the way that when you very first meet him, the first thing he says to you is, can you keep a secret? Tantalizing.
I swear that's true. That is not literary. There's no poetic license in that. Those were the first things that he said to me. Yeah, so everything was sort of hyper dramatic, of course it was, but, you know, but he's, and honestly, all the people around him, I mean, you know, everybody in the band, everybody in all of those bands, you know, because I've done a lot with the Revolution guys, but this was sort of the NPG era and spending a lot of time with those guys. And I've done things with them all over the years. And they're all just really good. You know, he works with Minneapolis musicians. Like, he doesn't work with all stars. He sort of keeps people around that he can work with in that way. And so just being in that environment actually was always really sort of welcoming.
Alan, going back to Vibe, can't spend too much time on this because we've got lots of other things to talk about, but the whole sort of story of how Vibe, you know, became part of this sort of East Coast versus West Coast sort of battle, and how Vibe almost became part of the story and was then accused by people like Russell Simmons of kind of stoking it. Now, this was on your watch. How do you look back all this time later on, you know, that really, I mean, really now just extremely distressing time, which ended up with the deaths of Tupac and Biggie. How do you look back on that now?
Look, it was, you know, obviously it was awful and super tense and, you know, on all fronts to figure out. I think there's a couple of things that people need to remember a little bit. And one was how, you know, there was radio and there were a couple of magazines. Like, that was how this, all of this culture was handled. There was no internet. It wasn't really in the sort of mainstream, you know, regular media still at this point. But also, when we were working on magazines, we were working 3 months. We were working with magazine lead time. You know, this was not responding minute to minute in the way that we think about covering this stuff now. And look, of course, you can look back after the fact at things that happened and say, oh, should we have phrased this differently because we know what happens, or should we have done this or that? But all of the coverage that we were doing was keeping up with the things that were happening. I mean, yeah. Obviously the thing that we get, you know, that we get, that I get a lot of, you know, a lot of criticism for and a lot of second guessing for was when we did the East versus West cover line on the Biggie and Puffy cover that was the Juice issue that year. If you go back and look at that story, this was after Tupac had put out Hit 'Em Up.
Right.
Like this was after the most incendiary, you know,
right.
piece of any of this had come out. This is after, I think it was the Dog Pound did the New York, New York video where they stomp on the New York City skyline. You know, these are in the piece. So it's not like in writing that we were out ahead of
sure.
any mm. of this conflict. No. And I think a lot of it was, you know, for obvious reasons, a lot of the hip hop press to that point were fanzines and they were sort of cheerleaders and they were advocates for the music, you know, as they should have been. But I think there wasn't a lot of how would journalists cover this?
Yeah.
Like, how is this a news story? And if, you know, if in the right world, Time Magazine were covering this, at, you know, not as crazy, these crazy hip hop kids, but like doing real reporting around this, that's what our readers were talking about. That's what they were, you mm-hmm. know, that was the thing. And it would, you know, to not cover that, to not address that because we felt like we need to protect them too much and it's, you know, it's sort of too hot to handle. I don't think that was, you know, that would have been the right journalistic call either.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, look, there's, you second guess everything and I can't say, oh, this, we did the perfect job handling this stuff. Sure. But I, journalistically, I stand by everything. I mean, we did definitive coverage of Tupac's murder in ways that continue to be validated by the recent charges that
right.
you know that finally came out. All yeah. of that still confirms reporting that we did the week that it happened.
Wow. Yeah,
so
that's fantastic.
It's, you know, there's a lot of things. And the other thing of that is for all of the East West, for all of the tension and all of the, like, that isn't what happened. That's not how, you know, the reason that Tupac was killed. Like, yeah. as that reporting came and as it's, this was gang, you know, this is gang stuff in LA. Yeah. This was the, you know, a fight earlier in the day. This was stealing. This was, you know, a lot of things. But, you know, to say, oh, but that throwing gas on the fire led to these tragedies, I don't actually think that's the way that the story right. really unfolded. And, you know, if we were, you know, sort of excessively blunt in the way that we talked about it, I do ask people to remember, like, that's what everybody was talking about every minute at that time.
Yeah.
That was the story.
You know, see, grab your blocks when you see Tupac. Call the cops when you see Tupac. Who shot me, but your pumps didn't finish. Now you're about to feel the wrath of a menace. Nigga, I hit him up.
Can we jump to Spin at this point? You take yeah. over as editor-in-chief at Spin in 1999. And I think not really to talk so much about Spin as what you had learned as an editor and learned about, you know, dealing with writers, nurturing writers, and dealing with budget, yeah. All that stuff. What did you feel differently? Did you feel like you had a lot more experience from your Vibe years? And was it a different experience at Spin for you?
Well, so, you know, Vibe grew so rapid. Once we started growing, we grew so rapidly that, you know, we went from 200,000 circulation to 600,000 circulation in, you know, during the time that I was in under 3 years while I was editing. And that change in circulation, you know, you're running a really different magazine at that point. I mean, there's really different expectations about what sort of numbers you need to put up, what sort of newsstand sale you're expected to deliver, all of those things. So I got a crash course in a wide swath of what it was to edit magazines in a very brief period of time going through the success that we had with Vibe. Mm-hmm. So we got so big that, you know, we ended up acquiring Spin. I sort of worked with both for a little while, was writing for both, edited a couple of books, the Tupac book that you mentioned before, the Vibe History of Hip Hop book that I put together. And then there was a feeling that, like, Spin kind of needed to stabilize a little bit, and they asked me to come over and take over in that chair. And Spin was the biggest challenge, you know, say in some ways the biggest challenge of my career, because this was a funny, you know, it's the late 90s. Hip hop is now fully, you know, entered the pop music
mm-hmm.
arena. Yeah. The teen pop stuff is now starting to explode. 99 is the big Backstreet, Britney, you know, NSYNC year. The alt-rock moment has passed a bit, and the big rock bands, a lot of it is like the new metal stuff. I mean, this is the run-up to Woodstock 99, right?
Yeah,
so this is all of that stuff.
Yep.
And so taking over Spin, there was a real sense of like, I can tell you all the things that this magazine isn't. We're not doing Britney, Rolling Stones doing that, and we're not a hip-hop magazine, Vibe is doing that. But getting a handle on what are we was very, very challenging. Felt very erratic. I mean, I'm really proud of a lot of the writing that we put in that magazine, but I never felt like we fully put our arms around what do readers want this magazine to be. That was the hardest part, because we would be like, okay, let's do something. Let's do a Radiohead cover. Like, okay, great. You know, this is before a lot of the Rolling Stone wasn't doing a Radiohead cover yet. And we do a Radiohead cover and it would do fine. And they're like, okay, well, maybe not. What if we do like a dumb big rock cover? What if we do, you know, a Kid Rock cover? Yep. And that would sort of also do fine.
Right.
You know? Yes. So there was no sense of, oh, okay, this is the space, like we could do. So I ended up doing a lot of those, you know, terrible band, doing, you know, putting Creed on the cover when they were had two albums that sold 10 million copies and nobody would talk about them. Or putting Fatboy Slim on the cover. And it never felt like, okay, this is the thing that we should be doing. And that part of it was very, you know, was really frustrating.
I mean, were you in a sense the victims of the atomization of the sort of the pop industry at that sort of
Sure, absolutely. Point? Absolutely. And a sense of like Spin had grown, you know, because I inherited Spin with a certain commercial Spin also, they grew the same way that Vibe grew through that big hip hop moment. Spin had grown through the alt-rock explosion and being the one to do all the Seattle covers when Rolling Stone wouldn't do them yet. So here's a magazine that has to deliver 500,000 readers every month. And who out there, like what are the sort of foundational artists that can do that?
Yeah.
The person who really emerged during that time, you know, when I was editing Vibe, I could have put Tupac on the cover every month. Like everyone sold bigger than the one before, that we would get insane media coverage. We would get tons of, you know, literal like reader mail at that point. The person who kind of emerged for Spin, you know, a couple of years later was Eminem.
Right.
Like I could do anything Eminem and it would work. But then
interesting.
We were
sort of, it's a hip hop artist, isn't it?
Yeah. And then we were sort of competing then Rolling Stone wanted to do everything Eminem and I couldn't always, you know. So in terms of editing, I know that you want to talk about editing the sort of editing the words, but editing in the kind of figuring out what is the point of view, what is the perspective of this magazine?
Absolutely.
Who is the reader that we are trying to speak to and trying to speak for? That was a very difficult phase to do that.
This is fascinating. This is really fascinating stuff.
You know, and then I left sort of just as The Strokes, The White Stripes, you know, are emerging and at least giving, okay, that's the identity. That can be the identity of this magazine, at least for, you know, this next chunk of time.
Yeah.
I sort of fell right in between that, where it just a lot of times felt like we were, you know, flailing a little bit. That said, I do feel like the Vibe experience, you know, I felt much more confident in terms of how you put together sections of a magazine, how you edit copy, how you do work with writers. I was blessed in the way that, you know, Danielle was sort of my number two at Vibe and really helped me figure that out. A woman named Saya Michael, who had been sort of an assistant editor at Spin, I promoted her up to be my executive editor and my number two. And Saya, I think, is absolutely brilliant. She's now the culture editor at the New York Times.
Yep.
She's been there for many, many years. I was out with her last night. She's still one of my dearest, dearest friends. And, you know, and I could not have gotten through that without her and without somebody as, you know, as smart and as, you know, that I could work 100% honestly and closely with as that to try to figure all of this stuff out. And so we ran stuff, you know, The single piece that I am proudest of, and this is an interesting moment, was, you know, Woodstock 99 happens. We are, again, a monthly magazine with a 3-month lead time. And there's the sort of that moment, like watching it unfold, and especially at the end, watching it turn into this disaster, of saying, we could do this as a news story in the front of the book. That's, we had people there, you know, on the ground. We could do a one page of, hey, this thing happened. And we actually sat down and we're like, you know what? This is a franchise story for this magazine. Like, if this isn't, you know, what we're doing, then I don't know what we're doing. And we literally got our writers and had them turn around and go back.
Yeah.
And we threw a team of writers at that story on the ground, going to the, you know, police office in whichever county in New York. We had people calling the families. We threw as much as we could at it. And we ended up doing a, like a 10,000 word, deeply reported what the hell happened at Woodstock 99. That is this absolutely the piece I am proudest of from that tenure, which won a bunch of awards. Great.
Yeah.
But all of these multiple documentaries that have come out, you know, however many years later, 20 years later,
sure,
everything that we wrote in that piece, every word holds up.
Yes.
Like, they have not, of course they've filled in other voices and other details and everything that you could do, but essentially, we got that story right in the moment and delivered a piece that stands as you know, definitive at the time, with the limitations of monthly journalism.
Absolutely.
That, you know, like, that was, you know, a real high point.
It really reminds me of, I mean, because I think it's fantastic, the coverage of that. Really reminds me of how Rolling Stone covered Altamont all those years before.
Exactly, 100%.
Yes.
You know, really just putting writers in on the story, really digging deep at all the sort of aspects of it. It's fantastic.
And again, having to confront that moment of, is, you know, is this a thing?
Yes.
We have people there. Are we just going to sort of, you know, mention it and move on?
Yeah.
Or are we going to really say, what does this mean about where this music is, where this culture is, where this audience is at this time? And that was at the model, you know, in our brains,
right,
I think,
okay,
throughout, was, you know, was exactly, you know, Altamont. And in some ways, you know, that was a brave thing for Rolling Stone early on to look at rock and roll culture and look at the Stones and look in the mirror and say, you know, this is
ugly.
This is ugly. This is, you know, this is really terrible. Yeah. You know, that's a thing you could just sort of sweep under the rug and move on. So, you know, those were the things that were, that we had the reporters and the editors who were up for that job.
Yeah.
It's Philly. It's just one of those days when you don't want to wake up. Everything is drunk. Everybody sucks.
It's really interesting hearing you talk about trying to figure out the role for Spin as a magazine. And I'd be curious to hear what you felt at the time. Obviously, the music business shifted a whole lot throughout the 90s and early noughties, and the whole commercialization of it and the whole, that just the money flowing and flowing. What did you feel at the time? What do you feel looking back was the role of the music magazine on the whole in that scene?
I mean, that's the other thing, of course, that's astounding is, you know, during that time, of course, we ran the first, hey, what's this thing called Napster story? I mean, this is that moment, right?
Yeah.
This is, I'm there from 98 to 2002. Like, that's the other thing that's happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, at a, I don't want to keep returning to it, but the, you know, now what feels like the sort of glacial pace of being a monthly magazine, where that stuff is changing so rapidly that we're like, okay, what's going to make sense when this comes out 2 months from now? You know, is any of this even still going to be how people are thinking about this stuff? Mm-hmm. So I do, you know, it's a moment of, again, on the one hand, this massive, I mean, 1999, I think still is like the biggest year of CD sales of all time, because it was all those teen pop groups. There were, I think, 6 albums that sold 1 million copies their first week that year. Like, it's just insanity.
Yeah.
You know, thriving economy, echo boomers coming of age, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then immediately you slam into, and now Napster comes out and digital distribution, you know, explodes the entire thing. So it's sort of the last, you know, it's obviously the last gasp of writing about this stuff before people could click on a box and listen to it without having to spend any money to listen to it,
which
is, you know, clearly completely rewrites, you know, the, what, as I'm sure you talk about every single week, what music journalism is supposed to be doing. But, you know, this was the access to these, like, this was, you know, now we live in a world where celebrities don't have to talk to the media because they can engage with their audience directly and tell them everything they want to tell them.
Yeah.
We, you know, the magazines were the one place that you could speak to your fans. It was the yes. one place that there was, you know, what did you want to signal? What did you want to do? This is a peripheral thing, but it always makes me laugh. I put Tool on the cover of Spin, which I'm actually very proud that I did, and was a good call. But like, what do you do with those guys on a magazine cover? So we shot this photo that was the four of them, and it had like a light beam across their eyes. And the business side, we had a new CEO, just went insane and was like, you can't put this on the cover. You can't see their eyes. You can't see their face. Like, this breaks everywhere. And I'm like, dude, those guys could walk into a room of their fans and no one would know. Like, that's the whole thing. So to just show four guys standing there is yes. nothing. Like, let's make it that it's this weird thing and you know, you're not showing it's that it's the mystery. And then that sold really well for us, you know, that ended up doing, you know, being a good cover for us. So playing those sorts of games of what do these artists, you know, what is it that they want to be telling their fans about? What do fans want to hear from them at this moment? How do they want to be presenting themselves? Those felt like very, you know, vital and crucial things at that time in a way that very soon after they just didn't.
So look, post-Spin, Alan, you essentially went back full-time to writing. I mean, I know you consult and do all kinds of things, but you've been writing and you've interviewed, you know, many of the sort of biggest stars of my musical lifetime. And, you know, I guess none comes any bigger than Taylor Swift, an interview with whom we're running by you from 2014 in this very pivotal year and moment in her career, the 1989 album that comes out that year.
Yeah.
There's a YouTube video of her talking to you. And, you know, I mean, I know you have, I think you've interviewed her a few times.
A few times, yeah.
I mean, one of the biggest stars in the kind of history of popular entertainment. You know, we're coming into this year where, you know, she's such a huge star. She's being accused by far-right Republicans of being a Biden psyop and yes. all of this stuff going on. Could she win the vote? Could she win the election for Joe Biden, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, how did this young woman become the stratospheric superstar that she is?
So actually, and I don't know if it's a thing we can post or not, you know, but I sent you this little YouTube clip, and that's actually not from when I talked to her for that Billboard cover. That was from the first time that I met her, which was, I forget the math, but about 10 years before. The first time that I met Taylor and the first time that I did anything with her was, you know, when Fearless came out, when her second album came out. She was 18, I believe. And I was doing a project. I was doing something with MSN at that time. And I went down to CMA Fest in Nashville and we set up a thing back. It's like saying that you could get access to, you know, that when I did my Ice-T cover at Rolling Stone, I spent 3 days with him, you know, going shopping for screen doors and, you know, whatever, because nobody else was, you know, was asking. This was sort of before the world really discovered country music, you know, stardom. Mm-hmm. And so we set up a thing backstage at the CMA Fest. And I did, over the course of the couple days of that festival, like 26 different interviews with basically every star in Nashville. I mean, we did Carrie Underwood and Keith Urban and Tim McGraw and Alan Jackson and, you know, everybody. Cause again, there wasn't a big, huge clamor for people to get to them. And so Taylor was sort of the big emerging star at that moment. Again, it wasn't from day one, but it was as the second album was exploding and she was clearly becoming something else. And meeting that girl when she was 18 years old was so striking to me. And the things that have unfolded in all the years since then, she was so smart and funny and kind of spontaneous and not like weird pageant girl. You know, what was clear was no one was pulling strings.
Right.
You know, for this young woman. This was not, you know, there was no Svengali. There was no, you know, this was her. Mm-hmm. And that was clear then. Like talking to her, you know, briefly at that point, and again, shooting this little video, if people are able to watch it, it's just funny to me to have, here's the first moment that I saw her, you know, on a video.
Yeah.
But that was really, I was a fan, like, I like those first records, but like, I was a fan, I was a believer then. Mm-hmm. I don't know what she's capable of, but this is, there's something special about this one. And that's everything that's borne out. And I think that this incredible way, almost unprecedented way, that, you know, she is so incredibly finely attuned to her audience and to, you know, what they need from her, what they want from her, and not just what they want from her right now, but what they're going to want from her 6 months from now,
right,
is unlike anything. I mean, at a certain point, unlike anything that pop's ever seen. Nobody's done this this long at this scale, continuing to get bigger. Ever. No one's done that. Yeah. Overlay her, whatever it is, 16, 17 year career on anybody, on Beatles, Elvis, Michael, Stones. Mm-hmm. No one is consistently getting bigger, you know, 17 years into a career in the way that she is doing. So I've done a few things with her. I did this Billboard cover with her when 1989 came out, Barney, as you mentioned. As you said, it was a pivotal moment of her shifting. Look, Red, you know, the previous record, Red, had had a lot of pop elements and pop hits on it. But 1989 was the sort of, you know, we're not going to be working this record to country radio.
Right.
This is a record that we're going to take out to the pop world.
I love that she goes to her manager, I think, and he says, okay, fine. I get it. It's a pop record, but can we not put a fiddle on Shake It Off? Just allow me a fiddle. And she just goes, no, absolutely not. You're not hearing me. Yeah.
You know, finesse it a little bit as we get across. But again, I think this, you know, now, even in retrospect, we think like, well, what was the big deal? I mean, she was obviously a pop star before then, but then it was a big deal that she was going to shift lanes from a community that had, you know, supported her so strongly, elevated her to the kind of stardom that she had reached, and say, I'm playing a different game now. Like, this is about something else. But again, what was so striking was not just the record was great, but, you know, having the time with her to hear what sort of vision, you know, what sort of sense she had for who she wanted to be, and her sense of, you know, we all know there's nothing harder being a teen star and then growing up and continuing a career, you know.
Yeah. Especially as a woman, as a young woman as well.
Especially as a young woman, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen what that leads to, and we've seen the like, okay, so today I'm going to start being sexy, and like it all, you know, becomes ridiculous. And to make the transitions that she made where she continues to bring that initial audience along, continues to grow the young audience. You know, it's just every piece of it is remarkable.
Yeah.
I think one of the really crucial things about it is just how much she manages, you touched on it earlier in what you were saying, manages to speak to her fans in a way that is just innately relatable to them, whether that's relatable through the music, through the lyrics, or relatable as a person. We were having a conversation yesterday about her in the office with our colleague who is a sort of, you know, former Swiftie, still really likes Taylor Swift, but, you know, isn't a teenager anymore, right? But still likes Taylor Swift a lot. And it was really interesting to hear her speak about how it was basically just that she was relatable. You know, you could see yourself having a conversation with her. She wasn't like super choreographed, wasn't great at dancing, was sometimes a bit awkward on stage at events. And so it was just this person who you could almost be friends with in that very modern, very parasocial way that we now all experience through social media.
Yeah, and I think really understanding that it all comes from her.
Yeah.
I just think is a thing that, you know, can get lost in all of this when we talk about the achievement. And and again, that was, you know, that was there from the beginning.
Yeah.
And also that it would be very easy at a certain point to get to a certain level and kind of, you know, bring in a superstar manager and kind of hand that over to somebody else to run. And that, that instead it's always remained all her out.
Yeah.
And I do miss, I mean, I understand all the reasons that Taylor Swift doesn't give interviews, you know, any doesn't really do anything anymore other than that, you know, Time Magazine Person of the Year piece was the first in 3 years, I think, that she'd sat for any kind of a print interview.
Right.
But, you know, I miss it a bit only because I miss hearing her talk about stuff. I mean, I miss hearing her answer questions because I think she's so goddamn smart that, you know, we really do learn when she does put herself out there to open up. So I'm, you know, I am glad that I had the time around her to do some of this stuff and get some sense of that.
Nice to meet you, where you been? I could show you incredible things. Magic, madness, heaven, sin. Saw you there and I thought, oh my God.
Do you think she might come out and urge her billions of followers, particularly her American fans, to vote for Joe Biden?
I mean, it's obviously, it's all purely speculative, but I think yes. I mean, she did in 2020, late and small, but she did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you watch that, you know, people have been circulating that clip from her, the Miss Americana documentary, where she decides to endorse the candidate running against Marsha Blackburn in the Tennessee Senate race, and has the argument with, you know, her team, who are saying, just don't do it. Like, half your audience don't want to hear that. They're not going to like it. It's like, I have to do this. This is important to me. And I just think for the sort of cultural issues, I mean, leaving aside the sort of geopolitical issues, I think obviously with reproductive rights so very clearly on the ballot, with LGBTQIA plus issues so forward in what these votes mean, things that she has come out and talked about as important things to her, I think above and beyond the sort of candidate endorsement, I just don't think that she can or would sit out, you know, the stakes around some of the issues that are very visibly on the table right now.
Will you be disappointed if she doesn't?
I will be. I don't think it's an obligation. No. And I want to be careful. I don't think that, you know, this is something that artists, that's mandatory. But again, because she's spoken about how some of these things and written about how some of these things are important to her, you know, having established that, I think it's a, it would be appropriate, it's, you know, to follow through and say, okay, this is, you know, now is when this matters, and let's do something about it. So, you know, I would, of course, we would all understand, but I would be let down given how much and where she has put herself out there on some of these questions.
Sure. It's extraordinary as well, going back to the point at which you interviewed her in 2014 when 1999 comes out. That's a point at which, yes, she's successful, but also there's a sense in which a lot of people really don't like her and really object to her. And there's the whole Kanye thing.
Some of that stuff comes subsequently. There's plenty of people who don't like her at this point.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that the all of that stuff that then leads into the Reputation album comes.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, sort of.
It's
on
all.
The tail
it's all
of,
on a. You know. It's all. It's all kind of coming through. And I think one of the things that's extraordinary is that she has kind of. I mean, not to lean too much into the pun, but she's kind of shaken that off in a sense. Like, she's so titanically massive now that it kind of doesn't really matter whether people hate her or not. It's like she's just there and she's everywhere.
Yeah, and look, honestly, I think that it's in some ways it's to her benefit if there are, you know, when there is some pushback. I mean, I think that her fans feeling like they have some skin in the game of fighting for her.
Yeah.
You know, not that any of that's intentional, but, you know, she, when it happened, when that came, she leaned into it, right? That's what the Reputation album, you know, was.
Yes.
And when we get the Reputation Taylor's version, it'll bring a lot of that stuff back up. And I think even as, you know, world conquering as she is, when her fans feel like they still have to, you know, kind of be soldiers for her, I think ultimately only adds to the fervor. Yeah.
What do you make of the Taylor's versions?
Well, I mean, I think going back and looking at it, so I think when you go back and look at the 1989 piece, what's so fascinating is there are open questions of like, is this going to work? You know, is what she's going to do, what she's trying to do in terms of elevating herself as a pop star? That was not a 100% given at that moment that was going to happen. You know, and similarly, when you go back and look when she announced and started the Taylor's version stuff, the level of skepticism, I mean, they're, you know, God love him. There's a guy named Bill Wordy who's, you may have some stuff. He worked at Rolling Stone, worked at Billboard, and he's now runs the music program at Syracuse University, and he does a newsletter, a sort of industry newsletter, and he reposted. He's like, here's the piece I wrote when this Taylor's version, you know, announcement was made. And it's like, this is never going to work. This is a terrible idea. No one's ever pulled off anything like this. Like, why is she doing this? And he's like, I was completely whiffed. Like, I just missed the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, part of it, the skepticism, I think, ultimately played to her advantage in some ways with her fans feeling like we got to show up and support. But I think the brilliant thing that she did with it was, you know, these the expanding them and including the other songs, the new songs, the alternate, obviously the extended All Too Well. She shifted. Initially, everybody went in saying, are these going to sound enough like the originals that we will listen to them? That very quickly became, oh, look at the other things that she's doing here and, you know, adding these other songs and filling out these stories and, you know, opening it up to it's a bigger project than just that. And that sort of happened instantly. And I think it really changed. It wasn't, nobody talks about them in terms of how do these recreate the originals?
No.
Mm-hmm. You know,
but, I mean, the cynical view is that, you know, she's excellent at selling the same album over and over again. I mean, she does it with the physical media. She's sold, I don't know how many versions of each album that have come out on different colors and different pressings and all this sort of thing. But musically, what's in it, you know?
Yeah, but listen, not to make too much of it, but we're here, we're talking about Prince and we're talking about Taylor. Yes. And there is obviously a through line
for
them in the ways that they have challenged, you know, that they each challenged sort of music industry.
Yeah.
Norms and structures. And I think in both of those cases, what's, you know, the remarkable thing is that they're the ones who are able, you know, the ones who have the ability, who have the circumstances and who have the, you know, privilege is the wrong word, but, you know, they're able to take those kinds of big swings because they have those kinds of platforms, right? Yeah. And she did it much more, you know, Prince did it and everybody thought he was nuts. We know that. The changing his name, the, you know, trying to break the contract, the writing Slave on his face, the putting out music through the internet. Everybody thought all of these things were crazy. And all of these things are what everybody then takes as given and immediately talks about as the issues of the music industry, you know, decades later. Learning from those examples, obviously, she was able to do that in a different way and in a much more sort of seamless and actually build a team that could execute, where with Prince, that was always the problem, is he would always have the right ideas and then get rid of anybody who disagreed with him or challenged him and then couldn't actually do the stuff that he wanted to do. Footnote to all of this, I still say that was the fatal error, God help them, when U2 did the album giveaway iTunes thing. The line that it should have been presented with is basically, we're the sort of act who can experiment with stuff, you know, let's do this and learn so that the acts coming up can learn from that and see. Like, that to me was the way you could have framed that that would have worked much more is, you know, of course it's the superstars who can take super chances. And that's what Prince did. And that's what Taylor did to different effect. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's recognizing what comes with that platform.
And I think she deserves credit for taking a stance on her masters and taking on Scooter Braun in that way.
Well, and also, again, just bringing that up for every artist who signs.
Exactly.
Now,
exactly. You know,
putting that on the table.
It's time to talk about the week's new audio interview, and there's probably only a tenuous, like, country music connection between Taylor Swift and Townes Van Zandt. Nonetheless, Townes would have been 80 years old if he'd lived a slightly healthier and happier life. On, I think, March 7th, he would have been 80. So we have dug out this audio interview that he did with John Tober in 1987, and Mark is going to tell us a bit about it.
It takes place on 16th of October 1987, which is amusing for us Brits because that's the day after the hurricane, the 1987 hurricane, which they refer to in this piece. It's the first time he'd ever come to England. About a week later, he played the Mean Fiddler in Harlesden. And he starts off talking about Butch Hancock, his pal Butch Hancock, and how different he is. Butch Hancock is a guy who's fairly driven by his career, does stuff to be productive. And he's basically saying, I'm an idle bastard. I'd rather just kind of sit around kind of like doing my horses, you know, the making records. He talks about making live albums because his third live album is released around this time, as well as his new album, At My Window. Talks about playing solo versus having a band live. Talks about his friend Rocky Erickson, That must be some friend to have. And he talks about songwriting. Let's listen to this first clip. He talks about how he's kind of driven to write songs.
I really can't do anything else.
I understand.
You know, and I have a family and this, that, and the other.
Sure.
Have to make a living. And it's not that I would think, you know, I'd like to be, you know, a sea pilot or something like that. But it's kind of, you know, shade late to start.
I know what you mean very well.
I'd like to be almost say with anything but a miner.
I want to be a miner.
I could be a trapper, but I couldn't leave my family. And so, you know, if you get a raccoon skin, put a stamp on it, send it home, don't work that way.
How true.
I love that.
I know.
It's just priceless.
I love it. I love his voice as well. It's just his speaking voice is great. He talks about seeing Elvis and Ed Sullivan. That being like for so many other people, kind of a key moment in his life. And getting a guitar the following Christmas. Talks about Pancho and Lefty, which is his best known song, and you know the cover versions by other people. And he says, you know, one of it gives him pleasure that wherever someone's got an acoustic guitar, someone's going to probably play Pancho and Lefty at some stage. You know, it's in 1987, probably had a certain amount of truth to it.
Pancho was a bandit boy. His horse was fast as polished steel. Wore his gun outside his pants. All the honest world to feel.
He talks about Steve Earle, who is just in 87, it's just sort of really coming up, and his crew. Let's listen to this next clip. It's about that.
I haven't asked you about Steve Earle yet, and stickers and terrible things like that. Was he was a friend of yours some years ago?
Friend, still is.
Right.
See him all the time. He was kind of the younger member of a loose crew, you know, 5 or 10 guys, when, you know, everybody was deciding whether to be a folk singer or a songwriter or not, you know, whether to be an architect or not. Everybody's in that kind of deal. Jerry Jeff was kind of the oldest, and he had already become a folk singer. He had a lot to do with me coming to folks, and yeah, got Clark and I were kind of at the same level.
For with all neons burning bright, pretty lights, red and blue.
Yeah, so, you know, very much talking about this particular scene. He talks about also the death of Skinny Dennis, who's someone I'd never heard of before. It was a bass player who was sort of part of that scene. He talks about that in quite some detail. He talks about first seeing Lyle Lovett, who's again is a fairly new guy on the scene. Last thing, which Barney, I think, speaks to us, as he talks about Chips Moman owning Scotty Moore's guitar, the guitar that Scotty Moore played. We saw Chips Moman sell for a rather feeble price, that guitar, many, many years later, didn't we? At Sotheby's, was it? Or Christie's?
Sotheby's or Christie's in South Kensington. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Yeah, oh, so we saw that guitar sold for, actually, frankly, what would now be regarded as a pittance. Anyway, it's a lovely interview.
Well, I loved this interview, and I just want to, you know, give a shout out to John Tobler, because I'm fascinated in that whole group of people, and it's wonderful that John has sent us the audio interviews that he's done over the years with almost all of those mentioned, including Jerry Jeff Walker and Guy Clark. We now have 2 Townes Van Zandt audios on RBP. And for anyone who loves that Texas scene, it's a real kind of gold mine. Yeah. And after we'd added this I just checked in with you, Alan, and I was absolutely delighted to learn from you that you had spent more than one long evening or night with the great man. So just do tell us about hanging out with Towns.
Yeah, quick Towns story. So I'm hopefully not conflating two stories here, but as I remember this, Towns used to come through. Barney, you certainly remember the Bottom Line as a club in the village here that was sort of a big singer-songwriter place. Of course, it's where Springsteen did the famous run that got discovered and all that. And Towns would come through and play the Bottom Line a lot, sometimes with other songwriters, not. And I remember going to see him with our friend, I believe, Barney, friend of yours, Anthony DeCurtis, was sort of my mentor at Rolling Stone. I mean, really the person who kind of took me on and gave me a lot of my opportunities there. And in the early 90s, we spent a lot of time together and a lot of time going out to see. And we went to see Towns. And I believe it's because Anthony was friends with Eric Anderson, the great songwriter as well. And I think all of us ended up, or Eric introduced us or whatever it is. And we ended up after Towns' set going out with Towns to not quite an after hours bar, but a late night bar. And Towns clearly was there to stay as long as somebody else was buying the drinks. and then it became like when he would come through, we would go, if we could go, we'd go to the show and then go out. So probably, I don't know, handful of times, three or four times, we ended up out into the late in the evening with Towns Van Zandt, who was every bit the, you know, what you would think, the raconteur and the sharp wit. Remember, he looked over and he got a look in his eye and he said, Anthony, you a gambling man? And we both know, like, the answer to that is not
no.
Yes. So we sort of backed out of that one very quick. But, those nights were amazing. Really quick, I have to – Towns told – laid into one of these nights, many drinks into one of these nights. Towns told what I will always say is my favorite joke. And this takes a second, and you have to indulge me. I am not a stand-up, so my, you know. But if given the opportunity, keep in mind this is a joke with that voice that we just heard, Towns Van Zandt, you know, telling this joke. Guy walks into a bar, and he sits down. He says, "Give me three shots of whiskey." Bartender's like, "Okay," and he pours them and gives them. The guy drinks one, two, three, knocks him back, and gets up to pay. And bartender says, "No, you know, no thing. I'm just curious." Usually when people are drinking, they sort of order one shot at a time. Like, why did you order three at the same time? And he said, well, it's just sort of a thing in my family. I have two brothers. One lives in Dublin and one lives in Australia. We never see each other. So whenever we go out, you know, you have one drink for you and one for each of your brothers. Bartender says, oh man, that's really sweet. That's cool. Okay. Sorry, you know, don't want to intrude. Then, no, it's fine. Comes back the next week, sits down. Give me three shots. Goes like, oh, right, yeah, that guy with the brothers. Here you go. Good to see you, man. Comes in the next week. Bartender's like, hey, I know what you need. Three shots. Oh, these are on me. Puts them up. Guy comes into the bar the fourth week, and he sits down. He's like, okay, need your three shots. And he says, no, just give me two shots. And he gives him, and he drinks the one really slow, drinks the next one really slow, and he gets up to pay, and bartender's like, listen, I don't really know you. You know, you come in here, but I know why you have the three shots and hope everything's okay with your brothers and all. And the guy says, nah, my brothers are fine. I quit drinking.
Saw it coming. I love it.
That's fantastic. I love it. Oh. I love it.
Now, how much better would that joke be with Towns Van Zandt? Oh,
that's wonderful. Thank you. Told it beautifully, Alan. Well, so that's the audio interview. We are running out of time. Otherwise, I'd love to talk a bit more about Towns, who I do find to be an extraordinarily intriguing figure. Tragic figure, but it's wonderful listening to this and Holger Peterson's interview from, I think, the year before, 86. Yeah, just the sort of laconic Texan drawl. I'd love to have an audio book read by Towns.
It would probably take quite a while, though.
It'd be very long. Yeah, many hours.
Moby Dick read by Towns Van Zandt and it keeps you going till 2035.
Guys, are there any pieces you want to talk about that you've added to the RBP library? Alan, if you hear anything that sparks a memory, just like jump in.
Just a couple of things, really. I mean, the absurd band Loverboy, Doug Johnson from Loverboy to Dave DiMartino, Cream, 1982. He says, we keep it interesting and progressive in a way, but we also realise you can't go too far above everybody's heads. I mean, Ultravox and U2 are all exceptional bands, but they're not really commercially huge. We'd like to play anywhere in the world and get a huge response. Well, that worked out, didn't it?
Loverboy.
He's just a ghastly band. And now the next thing is actually from a monumental Paul Nelson special feature on Warren Zevon that's going in this week in Rolling Stone 1981.
Sure, I'm sure Alan will have read this at the time.
These are legend. I mean, the Paul Nelson Warren thing as a whole saga unto itself. Yeah,
absolutely incredible.
It's essentially as much about alcoholism as anything else. It's an entire 10,000-word kind of vast piece. Warren says, I said, God, just give me one more chance, man. Don't let me die a fucking coward. Not this way. Shit, anything but this. I'm dying from having avoided the pain of living. This is suicide, the same as the gun barrel in the mouth, except it's infinitely more cowardly. It's just the worst death, a chicken shivering, quaking, whiny death. There's no keel over, there's make a young and pretty corpse. I was 50 pounds heavier then. I weigh the same now as I did in high school. I mean, it's just, that's the sort of the tenor of a lot of this piece. I mean, he's also very funny. He says, 1969, Kim Fowley called me up one day and asked very simply, are you prepared to wear black leather and chains, fuck a lot of teenage girls and get rich? I said, yes. So we started working on Wanted, Dead or Alive for Imperial. While we're making the record, I had a sudden attack of taste and told Kim that I wanted to finish the album myself. And he very graciously waltzed out of the project. Wanted Dead or Alive was released in 1970 to the sound of one hand clapping.
did you ever interview Warren Allen?
I never did. No. I saw him play, but yeah, I never did any work with him. Memorably, this is a side note to a side note, but I remember seeing Warren Zevon play at Town Hall here in New York in, I think, 1987 or 88. Mm-hmm. The opening act was nobody had heard of a woman named Lucinda Williams, who played with a solo electric guitar.
Right.
Wow.
That's what I always remember, is it was Lucinda alone, but playing an electric.
Right.
And it was those songs from that amazing first, The Rough Trade album. That's one of my favorite records. Yeah. So that whole night of seeing Warren then and seeing, not knowing her at all, seeing her come out and open that show is the one that I remember.
Fantastic. Mark, is that the piece where Paul Nelson takes Warren to meet the great crime writer?
He talks
writer?
About it. It's referred to in the piece.
This Ross McDonald I'm talking about, who for sort of L.A. noir aficionados, I think he's up there with Chandler. He's an extraordinary crime writer.
Slightly obscurely, they keep referring to him by his real name. So if you lose track, you're not quite sure who they're talking about.
Okay. Kenneth Miller?
Something like that.
There is a wonderful biography of Ross McDonald by one of our writers. One of the early Rolling Stone contributors, Tom Nolan, wrote a superb biography of Ross McDonald. And Zevon and Paul Nelson do come into that biography. I love it. It's one of the great tangents of sort of rock and roll history for me.
I should probably mention Kevin Avery's Paul Nelson book.
Of course.
As well.
Since
that's its own kind of story.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And Paul
it's a
Nelson,
wonderful book.
Paul Nelson really befriended certain people that he wrote about. Jackson Browne, clearly. And oddly enough, Rod Stewart, which is, we had us scratching our heads a bit there, didn't it, Barney? You know?
Yes. The Rod that we know today doesn't seem to bear much relation to the Rod Stewart of Mandolin Wind, really, does it?
Well, and that's, Nelson would have worked with him in his Mercury days, right?
Yes.
That's the thing there.
Yeah,
so on the other, not from the journalism, but from the A&R side.
Yeah, but before signing the New York Dolls, of course. I wonder if is it possible he took Rod Stewart to see the New York Dolls? What do you think, Rod? Should I sign him?
Anyway, that's my lot, Barney. So.
Okay, beautiful. Thanks, Mark. Jasper, what have you got for us?
Just a couple of things. First of which slightly lowers the tone, but we did skirt over it earlier.
Lower than Kim Fowley producing.
Well, depends. Yeah, perhaps not. But it's Papa Roach interviewed by Ian Winwood in Kerrang, and you kind of very swiftly skated over nu metal earlier, Alan.
You definitely put them on the cover, didn't you?
We did, in fact. We did do a proper, I was going to say. It does actually all line up.
Yeah, but this is a very funny interview, and Ian Winwood seems to actually really quite like them. But Kobe Dick, the singer, gets off... Kobe Dick, go figure. But he just starts ranting. I've just been told on the telephone about how Metallica have recently done this interview in Playboy. And Metallica were talking about how there were a lot of big bands that were blowing up right now. And Kirk Hammett said, yeah, there's a lot of crap out there, like that band Papa Roach. And he said how he basically stole the fucking riff to Hallowed Be Thy Name from fucking Iron Maiden. And I'm just like, all right. And they all start ranting about Metallica. And then Tobin, one of the band members, says, I dig Metallica, man, but Kurt Cobain is on my shit list now. And they all like burst out laughing and they go, you mean Kirk Hammett? And then they all just start having a go. I bet you're going to write that we hate fucking Kurt Cobain now, you fuck. And he knows you mean Kirk Hammett. I can't believe you said that. Have you even listened to a record, you fucking piece of shit, Kirk Hammett? And they just, I mean, Metallica was cool back in the day before they started fucking shitting all over their fans with Napster. And now look at them. They're fucking millionaires who just don't give a fuck. Don't give a fuck about their fans or fucking anything. And then at the end, damn, dude, says Tobin with a smile and a slow shake of the head. We just talked a fucking gang load of shit.
I can see why you put them on the cover of Spin.
Yeah. Don't think we got that out of them. Now I'm a little disappointed.
it's a really funny, worth reading piece.
Cut my life into pieces. This is my last resort. Suffocation, no breathing. Don't give a fuck if I cut my arm bleeding.
And then to conclude is a piece, Mark Ellen in the Word on Françoise Hardy in March 2005. It takes us a while to warm up. My opening shot, a tangled query about which singers had carried on the tradition she'd begun, is either unintelligible or so monumentally boring that it's met with a fair amount of Gallic shrugging and, eventually, a sigh. So I'm panicked into simply lobbing a few random names at her to see if any get a reaction. It's a slow start, but, mercifully, the ice is about to melt. Names like Joni Mitchell, I am not fond of this singer. Joan Baez, or this one. It's something in the color of their voices. I'm very sensitive to the color of the voice. Debbie Harry, yes, I've heard about her. Not interested. How about Madonna? I don't like her face. It's not her fault, but I don't like it. I'm not attracted to her. I don't like the way she moves. She is very, what's the word? Vulgar. It doesn't appeal to me to get to know her work any better. It's really great. It's a really funny, funny, funny piece. You know, she just doesn't care for any of the above, basically.
Oh, that's absolutely wonderful. And that's it.
That's it.
I think we've come to the end of what's been a really wonderful episode. Much for joining us and being so interesting and funny and telling that amazing joke.
That's what we'll take away from all this. I've done my job here.
We will be back in a fortnight with Ira Robbins to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Trouser Press magazine. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, whatever platform you use, and give us a review if you can. It really helps. Do also, of course, visit Rock's Back Pages itself. Subscribers can read over 50,000 articles and listen to well over 800 audio interviews with everyone from Jimi Hendrix to Kate Bush to Kurt Cobain and Kirk Hammett. Check to see if your local library or academic institution subscribes to RBP. If not, suggest they take a free trial of the world's largest archive of music journalism. Do finally rush out and buy any of Alan's wonderful books, including the Greg Allman autobiography, Tupac, Vibe, History of Hip Hop, the book about Leonard Cohen's Hallelujah. Are you working on a book at the moment? There it is.
The Broken. Yes, my favorite of my books. There you go. Two things I wanted to, I should just mention. One is, I was on Sirius XM for a bunch of years doing a music talk show with my co-host Mark Goodman of early MTV fame. Yeah. They closed down our channel. They handed it over to Conan O'Brien. And so we recently relaunched our show as a podcast called Sound Up, which is available on all podcast platforms. So that's there for your listening. And I am working on a book. I guess I say it here because it's announced. And Barney, you'll respond. I am working on a book on the undying popularity and legacy of Fleetwood Mac's Rumours album.
Very good.
So I've been spending months talking to post-millennials, talking to the young listeners who continue to gravitate, I think, more than to any other classic rock album to this one. And it's been super fun talking to them. And then I'll figure out what story it is I'm going to tell.
Oh, great. That's excellent. Fantastic. You'll find links to all of the things Alan just mentioned in the show notes for this episode. And on that note, it is goodbye from me and Mark and Jasper. And it's goodbye from our wonderful guest, Alan Light. So all together now, goodbye.
That concludes episode 172 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Alan Light. Find all his books, including Let's Go Crazy, Prince and the Making of Purple Rain, and The Holy or the Broken, Leonard Cohen, Jeff Buckley, and The Unlikely Ascent of Hallelujah, at all good bookshops. To listen to his podcast, visit soundupod.com. The hosts are Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.